There's holiness all around us. There's a sacred dimension in us. Now get to work.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, Conversations and Life Lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. In the past couple of years, I have this reoccurring theme that keeps popping up in my life, and that theme is miracles. I've always believed in miracles. For example, a horrific plane crash and one person walks away, or a young family who's on their last dime and wins the lottery. To me, those are obvious miracles. But lately, I've been noticing little things around me that I could look at as a coincidence, but I prefer to look at them as small miracles. For example, this human body is so amazingly complex, all the organs and systems firing together, and it all works. Every morning I wake up and I'm given another day on this planet. It is kind of a miracle. Or I think about there's almost 8 billion people on this planet, and not a single one of us is a duplicate. No one shares the same DNA exactly or the same genetics. To me, that's a miracle. My guest today is Rabbi Michael Zedek, and he believes in miracles. In fact, he wrote a book called Taking Miracles Seriously, A Journey to Everyday Spirituality. Michael says that we all walk blindly through our lives, not realizing all the miracles that are around us. He said his life has been elevated by recognizing the miracles in his life. He recently wrote another book, and it is called Stories for Young Readers or Readers Who Wish to Stay Young. Michael is a great storyteller, and he believes that people learn through stories. We remember stories, and we can relate to another person's journey. So it's a great way to share messages. And he says, though this book is aimed at a younger audience, the lessons are universal. I can't wait to chat with Michael today. Hey, Michael. Thanks for joining me today.
Great to be with you so far.
So far? Yeah, no. And I'm in this habit of asking all my guests where they are coming from today. And where are you today?
I'm downstairs in our home in Leawood, Kansas, which is a suburb of Greater Kansas City, Missouri.
Right. That's okay. And so there's lots of things I want to talk to you about. I want to talk about your books, but I also want to talk about, I've never had the opportunity to interview a rabbi before. So I'm curious about, so I was raised Catholic. So is a rabbi what?
Don't hold that against you, Barry.
I know. So is a rabbi kind of like the equivalent of being a priest?
The larger cultural context, that's often the parallel: rabbi, priest, minister, imam, etc.
Right.
But a rabbi is not, by definition, a priest, because by definition, a priest is the representative of God to the people.
Okay.
And a minister, by definition, is a representative of the people to God. Rabbi means my teacher. And
okay.
So a rabbi is not more or less holy or connected to sacred than anybody else in the community. He or she may care more about that stuff, but is often viewed as what I like to call the pastorization of the American rabbinate. You know, you need a minister of some kind to get married. Well, I guess the some kind for Judaism is a rabbi. You don't need a rabbi technically to get married, because I'm not really a sacerdotal functionary, but
right.
that is what's been accrued to us in the American context.
I understand.
How about that for obfuscating?
Yes, that's very good.
It's rare to find a rabbi who's not married as opposed to a priest who might be doing a little on the side.
Yeah. Priests are not married technically.
I didn't say that.
I know. So tell me, what made you decide to become a rabbi? I would imagine it's a life commitment, right?
Yeah. Well, at least it seems to be for so far. It's only been 51 years, so probably going to stick.
Yeah.
I did not know I was going to become a rabbi. It happened by circumstance or accident. I very immodestly did very well as an undergraduate and had won some awards and whatnot. And one of them was a full ride plus compensation scholarship that paid for all my graduate education. 100 people in the country were awarded this, who showed great promise for careers in college teaching. I was teaching at Syracuse University at the time, and a gentleman came to see me, I thought at the time by accident. He was the director of recruitment, we would now call him admissions director, for the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, which is the seminary I went to. I had never heard of it, but I found him to be utterly fascinating. A peculiar example. When I met him, he was age 38, and those were the days of never trust anyone over 30. But he was a remarkably interesting man, charismatic. At age 33, he had stopped being a lumberjack and became a rabbi, shorthand for unusual man. What he had done is he looked at the list of the 100 people who had won this fellowship scholarship, and if they had the possibility of perhaps being Jewish, my last name's Hebrew, so it's very likely that I'm Jewish, he went to see them on the assumption of two things. One, they might be interesting candidates to be rabbis. And second, the school wouldn't have to provide any funding at all. They get full pay from my fellowship, right? Ultimately, we had a correspondence way before email. Come to the school. I don't know. Come to the school. And he made a wager with me. And that's why I'm talking to you today, in effect. He said, Michael, on the one hand, there's 4,000 years of the Jewish story on which people were prepared to put their lives on the line for the story to continue. On the other hand, there's you, who thinks it's of minimal consequence. Is it possible they're right and you're wrong? Give me 1 year. I gave him 1 year, and that turned out to be the rest of my life.
What were you teaching at Syracuse at that time?
Writing and English.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting way to get there. So I'm curious about, this is probably a big question, how do you think the future of religion fits into our future?
That's a big question, and I have no pretense at being in the prophetic prophecy business, but my assumption is that the secularization of our world, religion becoming for many people not a relevant phenomenon, will continue to accelerate. At the same time, I think there will be people for whom religions will become a vital means to establish and rejoice in the meaning of this journey. So the answer is it's both irrelevant and extraordinarily important. My own assessment is that everybody's religious. There are two religions fundamentally. There's a religion that says life is precious and meaningful. There's a religion that says life is meaningless, or to put it in the vernacular, life sucks. You'd be amazed how many people belong to that latter religion. For me, this is my assumption, and it empowers my days, my nights, and even my writing. There's holiness all around us. There's a sacred dimension in us. Now get to work. The religious vocabulary is often overworked by too many people, and it almost becomes meaningless. You know, Martin Buber, one of the great theologian philosophers of the previous century, said, if we would just stop using the word God for 100 years, when we opened our mouths, we might start making some sense. But for me, the issue is there enough evidence to prove that I am becoming the human being I'm supposed to be? Not is there enough evidence to prove God? There are times when I think the word God makes sense. There are times when I'm not sure.
How do you know that the human being you're supposed to be becoming?
Well, my guess is that I think there is an emotional context instinct that says, am I more caring today than I was yesterday? Am I more comfortable with my imperfections that then become less hindrances to my trying to grow into the person I am? And do I encounter all others with the assumption that they are of infinite value, especially and including when I disagree with them?
Right. So sometimes to me, it feels like religion polarizes people rather than brings them together.
No question. People, the argument from clergy is, all the awful things that are done in the name of religion.
Right.
You don't need religion to do awful things. I will admit that people rarely do it with as much enthusiasm when they're doing it in the name of what they think of when they use the word God. But it's the human flaw that is involved, not God that's doing that stuff. So for me, for example, the Hebrew Bible is not a book about God. It's a book about human beings constantly falling short. And then the question becomes, what do we do after we've fallen short? In effect, I think it's a sacred anthropology rather than a human theology. Mm-hmm. And what am I doing? What are we doing that brings more of the sacred into the present moment?
Yeah, I love the analogy of anthropology. I've never heard that before, and I like that.
Thank you very much.
Yes, it's very good. Do you believe that most sacred texts, including the Bible, teach more in metaphors as literal?
Well, I do not take the Hebrew Bible literally. Judaism has never understood it as a literal document. These are stories that convey truths, not a historical document that is simply filled with facts.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, can I elaborate for a sec?
Of course.
Martin Luther King has this wonderful suggestion. These stories, they talk about the Exodus, for example, mm-hmm. and the journey through the wilderness. These stories, and somebody used the word stories, these stories demonstrate that it's easier to get the slaves out of Egypt than to get Egypt out of the slaves. Barry, you and I know that's always true, mm-hmm. whether it's in ancient Egypt, if it ever happened, or a movement for a community's liberation or an individual's embrace of freedom. We are free mm-hmm. before we're willing to take responsibility for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's an over and over again metaphor that's explicit in every human journey. If you're familiar, by the way, my first book, Taking Miracles Seriously, has a different point of view using the same evidence. People are free to disbelieve the evidence of their own experience. I know that's true about me, and I make a presumption that others share the same blind spot. We walk sightless among miracles all the time, and we ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's what makes this journey more than a sentence to endure.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned your book, and I'm going to get to that next, but I have one more question before I do. What do you think is the intersection between faith, spirituality, and religion? How are those three things related?
But one of the fascinating things about the word faith is there's no word in Hebrew that means precisely faith. There's a word that's translated as faith, but it means, emunah is the word, it means confidence. There are moments when I have confidence. There's moments since I take my experience seriously when I'm unsure. Mm-hmm. But spirituality and religion, I'm going to quote a book. It's not one, but it's a great book. The Spirituality of Imperfection. Isn't that a wonderful title?
It's a great title.
Yeah. In the book, they use the following. Spirituality is for people who have been to hell. Religion is for people who are frightened of going to hell. Now, I like the analogy, but I would put it more definitively. Spirituality is the effort to lead a meaningful existence that makes this more than a sentence to endure. Religions are languages that try to embrace that, cultivate it, and grow it.
And so what you're telling me that, and faith is confidence.
Moments of confidence.
I like that too. I haven't heard that. I got some new things from you today.
Oh, for sure.
So now you've written two books, but the first book is Taking Miracles Seriously, A Journey to Everyday Spirituality.
That actually grew out of a lecture at Rancho La Puerta.
Oh, really?
And what? Yeah.
So what year did that book come out? It's not that long ago, right?
September of 2023. And it's in a second printing, so, oh boy.
Wow. So
Taking Miracles Seriously.
So what made you want to write that book? What in that lecture, what made that come on? Because I'm obsessed in the last couple of years with miracles, because I interview Deborah every week, and Deborah says you can look at things, everything is a miracle or nothing is a miracle.
Yeah. She's using Albert Einstein. Do you know the quote?
I've heard it, but I can't remember.
There are two ways to live. The first is as though nothing is a miracle. The second is as though everything is a miracle. I think it's possible to get closer to the second way. I don't think anybody can live on that mountaintop all the time.
Right.
But it is possible to be there more regularly.
Right.
So here's part of the problem. If I were to ask you to give me a definition of a miracle, I'm reasonably confident that you would include a supernatural intervention into the regular routine of experience, right? I hope you won't be shocked. The Hebrew Bible, once more, has no such word for that definition of miracle. There are words that are translated as miracle, but they don't mean supernatural intervention. The three most common words are nes, which means a sign or a symbol. Signs or symbols point to something more, right? That's what they do for a living. The next word is ot, which literally means a letter of the alphabet, which is an agreed upon sign that when we make this symbol, we mean, oh, why not just blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. We've agreed that this stands for something, points to something. Right. And the last one is pella, which means a wow or a wonder. Taken seriously, what isn't a wow or a wonder? Or to put it in poetic frames. Now, this is Elizabeth Barrett Browning from a wheelchair. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every bush is afire with God, but only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round and pluck blackberries.
Wow.
So I'm suggesting that there are burning bushes scattered randomly through every day, and what do? We ignore them. Ignore them less. By the way, taking miracles seriously tries to be a way to find greater attention to pay attention.
Is it stories?
There are stories in it. There are illustrations. The second book is just a storybook people remember stories. They don't remember essays. So the illustrations are what stick, right?
Right.
So the second book called People Are Like, Stories for Young Readers and Readers Who Wish to Stay Young it's got 9 stories illustrated. And it's each of the stories conveys empathy and compassion, at least I hope so, which are matters, what should we say, in short supply in our current environment.
Mm-hmm. So, and this, your second book was written for kids mostly, right?
I'd love to imagine that it can help generate cross-generational conversations. But it is intended for young people to be able to read on their own or for parents or grandparents, et cetera.
Right. So in your first book, Taking Miracles Seriously, you borrowed from like the Bible, Indian Japanese folklore, right? Einstein, St. Augustine, Groucho Marx. I mean, you threw a pretty wide net.
Deborah there, aren't you?
Yes.
She was a blurb for the book. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I've seen your lecture before, and I've watched a few podcasts that you did and talks online. You use humor a lot.
Yeah.
What do you think is the benefit of humor?
Well, first of all, I think it opens a person to really listen.
Yeah.
Second, it helps us continue to pay attention. And third, what's wrong with joy? It seems to me to be one of the better choices we've got until this journey is over, right?
Right.
Somebody once asked the Dalai Lama, "How, with all the difficulty your people and you have experienced, how can you still be happy?" Mm. And his response was, "What else would you suggest?"
Yeah, I agree. I think humor, my I'm sticking to it. I think humor is spiritual.
Yeah, well, you're one of the great paradigms of humor, even if it wink wink occasionally crosses a line into lascivious.
I know how to not cross too far.
Show up in this podcast today.
I step one foot over, but I keep one on the other side.
Yes.
So on one of your talks, I don't know if you were talking about this as a miracle, but it's something that I had never heard before. And I've been thinking about it, that people think, in the fall when the leaves change, that it's it's miraculous. But you said something about how it's chlorophyll, which makes the leaves green and is active when they're growing. It stops working. And then all the natural colors that were already in the leaves come out.
Yeah.
That's a... Yeah.
When I
love
that. I was also delightfully stunned. What's there becomes revealed. The treasures within, and I think that's a wonderful metaphor for all of us, right?
Right.
It's not that the tree changes, that the leaves change color. The leaves reveal what's there.
Right. So in this human condition, finding ways to reveal what's on the inside is the trick.
Well, right. It's for some of us, it's a great risk, but But I think we'd be paupers if we didn't take that risk.
Right. Now, and I saw you did a talk, I think it was on your miracle book, where you said there's four suggestions you have for people.
That's the TED talk,
which I thought was really great. What are your four suggestions for people?
Sure. First of all, you need to give credit where credit is due. It begins with a story that I heard from Phyllis Pilgrim. Phyllis and her mother, as you may know, mm-hmm. were imprisoned in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in Indonesia during World War II.
Correct.
Plus or minus 80% of the people with whom they were incarcerated didn't survive. They starved to death. Phyllis marveled until her mother's death, and her mother, as I recall, died in her mid-90s.
Yes.
How she maintained an enthusiasm and an embrace of life. Lesser things have turned many a person into a cynic or despairing expression of the human story that this is just a sentence to endure. So she asked her mom, how explain? What kept you able to embrace this joy you call life? And her mother answered, there were three things. And being a rabbi, I've added a fourth. And the four things are, every day of my imprisonment and every day thereafter, she would try to do three things: to see something beautiful, to hear something beautiful, and to say something beautiful. And I've added to that another, to do something beautiful. Every night before I attempt to sleep, it used to be easy. Now, as I get a little older, I'm with you. It's sort of my bedtime confessional. Did I see, hear, say, and do something beautiful? If the answer to any one of those questions is no, I have to get up because my soul, S-O-U-L work for the day isn't finished. And one of the things that's the magic in there is the more you do it, the more it's present in that there are burning bushes scattered mm-hmm. randomly through every day. And I can see them even if I don't take off my shoes.
Hi, my name is Jan, and this is my 23rd visit to the ranch. And the reason that I keep coming back is that the ranch taught me about self-care and how important it is. I've come here in many moods and many stages of my life, and if my heart is open and I listen, the ranch always gives me what I need, whether it be physical, spiritual, emotional, or also the other clients, the people that you are with. They're all here for the same reason you are, and they're so supportive as the staff is and everyone is. I think we all need to take time for self-care, and so I've shared that with my daughters and my family and some of my friends. And it makes us to be the most authentic version of ourself we can be, and making little changes in health and fitness and spirituality. The ranch is the place to do it because everybody here is authentic. They're willing to support you and help you in any of your needs or leave you alone if that's what you need to have done. Come to the ranch, you won't regret it.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I hope you are enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. So let's talk about the most recent book, when the stories for young readers and readers who wish to be young. Mm-hmm. That book came out when?
October 14th, 2025.
Well, it was just very recent.
Very recent. And one of the things I love about this book, aside from the illustrations, which I think are terrific, not mine, is that all the proceeds will go to benefit scholarships for needy kids. I'm not making a penny from this book, happily.
That's wonderful.
I agree. Maybe it's to do something kind.
So what is the organization that makes the decision of which kids get the scholarships?
Well, the reason why this became possible is because the cost of publishing the book was met by a wonderful donor.
Oh, wonderful. And
so the publisher is not worried about making money. I'm not worried about royalties. And a school here called the University Academy, which is a school of 1,200 kids, almost all of whom fall below the poverty line, will be one of the beneficiaries. And then a school here in the greater Kansas City area, which is a very fancy prep school that has scholarships so that kids who couldn't afford it can go, mm-hmm. will also be a beneficiary, assuming there are royalties, which right. won't be to me. Those are the two main places that will receive it. In fact, small story about the school. It's called the University Academy. 1,200 students. 4 years ago, the first group to go K through 12 graduated from the school. The valedictorian got into Harvard. Now, that's all wonderful. All the kids get into college, and the school founder pays for their education and pays for tutors while they're in college because some of the kids aren't ready. But here's the exquisite part. Got into Harvard. His father was the custodian of the school.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that a beautiful turning?
That's a beautiful story. Yeah. So I was a valedictorian, but I didn't get into Harvard. So
you're in a postgraduate course in excellence at Rancho La Puerta. How about that?
I've been in school my whole life learning things. So,
yeah, for sure.
What did you learn writing this book? Did there anything unique or special you learned? Surprised you?
I'm going to answer in a small detail, and then maybe it'll give me time to think of the larger response. One of the stories, as I had written it, was about two young girls. One of the young girls has a favorite toy that breaks, and she cries, and her friend stays to try to comfort her. She gets home much too late because she's tried to help and comfort her, and her parents are angry with her because she's late. And the editor said, why don't you change it to that her parents are proud of her because she stayed to help a friend who she couldn't fix, but she could help cry with her.
Right.
And I thought that was a brilliant recognition of being positive rather than negative. So that's a small part of what I've learned. And of course, what I've learned over and over again is how stories can outflank our resistance to grow or change. For me, I'm constantly integrating these stories as a reminder of, oh yeah, I've got to do that. Mm. Or for someone else. This particular book came out of a class I taught. Where, do you know the group Wilco?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, some of the listeners will. Jeff Tweedy, who is a frequent appearer on a lot of rock shows, he's my son-in-law says he's the Bob Dylan of his generation, is the lead singer and composer of the music. One of his two sons, I taught both of them, but one of his sons said, you know, Rabbi, you should publish these stories because I would teach in stories. Mm. And that sort of tweaked my imagination to write this book.
Mm-hmm. Where do you get your stories from?
Everywhere.
Everywhere?
Yeah. There's a story in here from a rabbinic source. There's a story in here from the animal world. There's a story in here from a philosopher, a very pessimistic philosopher named Arthur Schopenhauer, 19th century German philosopher. Despicably pessimistic about the human endeavor. I turn that upside down, I hope. There's a story in here from a book called The 100th Monkey, which was published in the 1960s. Stories stick, at least for me. Yeah. And
do you have a favorite story?
Oh, is that asking me to choose between my children, right?
Oh, no, that's okay then.
But I have a story that taught me to value stories. How's that for finessing?
That's okay. Yeah, that's very okay. Right. Well done. Not your first rodeo, I can tell. Yeah.
Well, as I sometimes tell students, listen, don't think you can ask me a question I don't know the answer to, because if you ask me a question I don't know the answer to, I'll turn it to a question, the answer to which I do know and hope you don't catch it.
Right.
But at any rate, I learned the power of stories from a story. I tried in my pulpit life, I'm semi-retired now, to never repeat a story. Or if I did, I would say, okay, some of you may recall getting them on my side. I was teaching a class of 12 and 13-year-olds. They were studying for their bar and bat mitzvah. And I began to tell a story about, it's 1,800 years old, about a rabbi who opens his mouth for the first time in the Talmudic discussions. He only appears twice. He's a minor character. His name is Rabbi Nathan. The sages are debating whether you should go to the gladiatorial combats of ancient Rome or not. And for the first time, he opens his mouth. All of them say, it's barbaric. We must stay away from such brutality. He opens his mouth and says, we have to go. And they say to him, Mahasiba, for those whose Aramaic is rusty, what's your reasoning? Mm-hmm. And he says, when the crowd shouts for the blood of the defeated gladiator and goes thumbs down, our job is to shout thumbs up. And I think that's a wonderful job description from which you never retire, because there's more than enough evidence to say, give up. You can't make a difference. What point does it make? Shout thumbs up. It might keep your spirits going. These kids were 8 and 9 years old when I used that story. It was at the end of a Yom Kippur morning sermon. They had no business listening. And a whole bunch of them remembered the story. That's how I found the magic of stories.
That's great. When you mentioned earlier about the girl who stayed to help someone and she could have gotten in trouble when she got home.
Yeah.
To me, that's kind of... it's almost a story about finding the positive to everything has two sides, and finding the positive is, for me, it's a personal miracle to find the positive in situations.
Yeah.
So I really like that.
May I wax rabbi for a second?
Sure.
One of the great stories in the Hebrew Bible is Jacob wrestling with whatever it is he wrestles with. And the text says in English, I will not let you go until you bless me. I didn't want this to happen. He's going to be wounded for the rest of his life. But I won't let this go by until I can find a blessing in it. I didn't want it to happen. Mm-hmm. What can I do to turn this into a force for good? As you may vaguely remember, my father died when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. You think I wanted that to happen? Right. But what's the blessing in it? He taught me some of the most critical lessons I know. May I? The lessons? Lesson number one, life is a very precious and fragile gift. Self-evident, right? Needs no elaboration. Lesson number two, were I to die today, I want more. I'm so intoxicated, to use a poet I love, Edna St. Vincent Millay, oh life, I cannot hold you close enough. Lesson number three, were I to die today, and I mean this, Barry, it would be enough to say thank you, or to use Hebrew, dayenu. It's enough. Thank you. I want more. But if this is all I get, I am grateful. Lesson number four, I'd rather have my father than have learned any of it. I can't have that, but I can have what his life still means in me. I will not let it go until I find the blessing in it.
I interviewed someone about grief, and it's also, you know, you can hold grief and joy at the same time. And what you're saying is you can, you know, the grief of losing your father, but there are some other things, ways that you can look at it as well. You can still hold both.
Yeah. Please send me the link to the one on grief. I'm doing research right now because I'm thinking, do I have a book in me about grief and how to deal with it?
Yeah, because we all, humans deal with it, but especially in our culture,
live long enough in love, you will encounter it.
So I do want to talk really good. You told a story about I think it was a Christian minister visiting Jerusalem for the very first time. I love that story. Briefly say that.
Reverend Fred Craddock was a wonderful storyteller. Mm-hmm. He's on his first trip to Israel, and the guide says, such and such a miracle happened here. And Craddock immediately suggests, I hope you don't mind if I have a different understanding. And the guide immediately responded, of course not. You can be sure if there's only one way to understand something, it didn't come from God. Now, wherever one is on the whole notion of God, a meaningless term or the most important term in the world, if there's only one way to understand something, there's probably a limited awareness of what the heck we're looking at.
Yeah, that's to me, that's very profound.
I agree. And it's the heart of the thinking that ought to be embraced in the world. In Judaism, we call it Devar Acher. It means another interpretation. Not my right and your wrong one, but another one, and another one, and another one. Should be intellectually defensible, but there's no one. This is the absolute, and there is no other.
Yeah. It's in, I was reading, there's a scientist who said this, that whatever you can truly prove in science, literally the complete opposite is also true. So there's no definites, which is...
In the first book, Taking Miracles Seriously, I cite I think he's an anthropologist who says, on Tuesday, I taught you this. In between, a paper came out that said, all what I taught you on Tuesday is wrong. And if you can't tolerate that, get out of science.
Right. Yeah, that's good. So, I do love the idea of miracles and seeing everything as a miracle. Like, an example I have, like, these are what miracles for me. Like today, as this morning, getting ready to leave San Diego in the dark to drive to the ranch, and couldn't find my key to my car. And I'm like, I always hang it in that same place. I'm looking. I sit down for a minute and like, okay, what did I do? Oh yeah, I climbed in the back seat of my car last night. Climbed in, there was my key. So to me, I could look at that as like, you were really stupid, Barry, for not putting that key back where you've, but it's a miracle that I found it. Mm-hmm. So I find those things happening every day.
Maybe an even better word than miracle, because there's an awful lot of people that bring the connotation of irrelevant or supernatural.
Right.
It's a wonder.
It's a wonder. I like that word.
It's a wonder. You know, days pass, years vanish, and we walk sightless among wonders, you know?
Among wonders, yeah.
Yeah.
When are you speaking at the ranch again?
Well, God willing, as we say in my business, August 1st.
Or August 1st. August 1st is coming here. Awesome. Yeah. So guests can come hear you. And again, why don't you show them pictures of your book so that if people that are watching can see what your books look like. Take a miracle seriously.
Live? I didn't have any makeup.
Yeah, it's all right. We'll edit it for you.
This is the first one. I didn't design the cover, but I think it's gorgeous. It's meant to be a burning bush, you know?
Yeah, I got it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't design this one. And this is the new book, the Young People's Book. Both of them are available on Amazon.
So I appreciate you taking the time to spend with us.
My great privilege. It's always, first of all, it's fun to be with you. I should have worn my bingo winning t-shirt.
Well, that's all right. I trust that you have one.
I do.
And we'll look forward to having you here in August where we can catch up. So thank you so much.
Of course, indeed. Thank you.
And keep doing the good work. We need it. My conversation with Michael today was so easy. It's like talking with a dear friend. Michael is not just a rabbi, but he's a scholar. He's studied philosophies and religions from around the world, and he believes each one has something to teach us and something we can learn from. I particularly loved his story that he told about the Christian minister visiting Jerusalem for the first time. The tour guide, of course, was a Jewish man. And at some point during the tour, the Christian minister raised his hand and said, "I see and understand what you're saying, but I choose to see it in a different way." What the tour guy said back to him, I loved. He said, "If there's only one way to understand or look at something, it's probably not from the divine." It reminds me that it's so important to ask the questions and to know that there are questions. Maybe even more important than the answers, because maybe there's not one answer, or maybe there's not an answer at all. I think there are miracles all around us, and nature shows us miracles every day. I think of the monarch butterflies. If you think about it, their brain has got to be the size of a pin, and their wings are so fragile, like tissue paper, yet millions and millions of them make a pilgrimage each year from Canada all the way to Mexico, and then in that same year, back. It's interesting because monarch butterflies have a lifespan of only 1 month. When it gets time, or the time draws near for this migration to happen, they shut down the reproduction and put all that energy into building stamina for the trip. And the monarch butterflies that make that pilgrimage actually live 8 to 9 months, not just 1 month. To me, that's a miracle. If that's not a miracle enough, they find the exact same tree in Mexico each year. How do they even find their way from Canada to Mexico, let alone the exact same tree and sometimes the same branch, because they mark them so they can follow them? So I hope that you can take a moment and notice some miracles that happen in your everyday life. And if you do, I hope it elevates the quality of your life. Until next time, this is Barry wishing you health, joy, and many miracles.